You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello and welcome to the True Blue LA podcast. I'm Jacob Birch. Eric Steven is here. And Eric, we've been starting every episode this season with a statistical update of the Dodgers MVP so far. So I need you to get your scorebook out. Are you ready?
Sure.
I need the Travis d'Arnaud statistical update.
Okay, so Travis d'Arnaud, had he remained a Dodger, at the time of last week's recording, he was a Dodger for one day. He is no longer a Dodger. He was a Dodger for 5 days and five games. He appeared in one of them. He was 0 for 1. So his Travis d'Arnaud stat update is 0, batting average, 0 on base percentage, and 0 slugging percentage. Full season pace, had he remained a Dodger, 32 plate appearances, over 32. So
it's pretty good. Not really a qualifying plate appearance number.
So what was the deal with that?
We've got a lot of good Dodgers news this year. This week, a couple of losses, but nothing too bad. But what a strange signing! Do you have any insight as to what the motivation, both to sign and to release so quickly, was?
It was a little weird, like in that, I mean. Like, just the way that that a lot of major league rosters are constructed these days with 13 pitchers, which the Dodgers have done a lot for the last, under basically Friedman and Zaidi when he was here. So it leaves only 12 position players. It leaves you with a short bench of only four players. And when one of those is the backup catcher, it limits your options. And so to have a roster with three catchers is crazy, or like very rare, at least in these times. And for the Dodgers to sort of do that, embrace that, even with sort of the pseudo flexibility of like, Austin Barnes, who could play second, and Russell Martin's played all over, but I mean, it's not like you would start any of these guys at, I think Barnes at second has the best case for like starting at second, or playing regularly. But even that, like, I would not want that for a full season. But even with that flexibility, like, it's still super weird to have three catchers on a short bench. But I think what it shows is, like, with the AJ Pollock injury, the Dodgers sort of immediate depth is sort of tested a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And like they called up Matt Beatty, and he was the one who was sent down when they signed. I don't know. I think it was just a case of like, as we've seen the last like 4 years, anytime you can make like an incremental upgrade, you do it and you just deal with it later. Like,
but then they gave up on the upgrade. Is this just a situation where after 5 days,
yeah,
they figured out he wasn't an upgrade?
Well, so they signed him. So like he was an ARB guy. He has 5 years of service time and nearly free agent. So he was like making just over $3.5 million with the Mets. They released him, so they're responsible for like all of his salary. So the Dodgers' commitment was dirt cheap. It was prorated share of the major league minimum. It's $555,000 for the whole year. And so they kept him, it would have been like, you know, a little bit over $400,000 for the whole year. So that's like, in baseball terms, it's nothing. It's literally calling up, like Matt Beatty was making that this year. So mm-hmm. It's a one-to-one wash salary-wise there. So it's like guy with major league experience, decent hitter against lefties, you know, not something you'd like, count on necessarily, but to have as a pinch hitter option, that's fine. So I think that's what it was. The thing is, he's out of options, or no, he has an option, but with 5 years of service time, you can't send him down without his permission. So essentially, effectively out of options. But think it's one of those things like he was there available. So they're like, well, we have an open spot. Let's get him. And if we can use him, great. If not, no big deal.
And so was it just a fact of whatever cast considerations they got from Tampa Bay just outweighed whatever upgrade over Rocky Gale he was?
Yeah, and so I think what it was is like Tampa Bay became more desperate because they're a contending team, and like both of their catchers were hurt, so like they truly needed a catcher. Whereas the Dodgers were like, they had Darnell like work out in first base and left field like over the first couple of days he was here, he didn't even play, and it was like, hey, if we use you, it might be later innings, you might have to fill in or whatever. And Darno, whatever, he's willing to do whatever. A couple years ago, the Yankees were desperate. They had a lot of guys hurt, so he started at second. I think we talked about this last week. It was the game where he and Azdrubal Cabrera, I'm sorry, the Mets, he and Azdrubal Cabrera switched off at second and third, depending on who was up. And so the box score looked ridiculous, but it was awesome because they like switched off like 15 times. And but Darno had never played either of those positions before professionally, so he had not played first or left either, but he's like, hey, I'm willing to do it. Ended up he didn't even get to do that. He pinch hit the one time. But so I think that's what it was. So Tampa Bay was desperate enough. I have no idea what the cash considerations was.
Yeah.
I doubt it was – I mean, it could have been $1 million. I doubt it was that much. But I think I think it all sort of counts, right? Like, so if they made a trade in, like, say, July, and, like, they're taking on, I don't know, like an $8 million salary, but it's really, like, $2.5 million, what's left of it. So if they can knock, like, say, $500,000 off or whatever they got from Tampa Bay in terms of, like, a luxury tax number, I don't – if that's what they're worried about, like, that helps. Anything on the bottom line helps. And frankly, like, Darno, while probably an upgrade over what they had, wasn't, like –
sure.
You're not going to like move heaven and earth to like keep him around. So I think they probably got enough to justify it. But it was odd. You're right. Like it was an odd fit.
All right. That's already 6.5 more minutes than I ever thought I would spend talking about Travis Darno. So
we'll just wait till we see the title of this episode. It's so, all Darno.
That's all it is. Do you have a Cody Bellinger update for us?
Yeah. Cody Bellinger, he is down. His pace is down to more human levels now. 54 home runs, 143 RBIs. So the 54 would be a Dodgers record. So, but he's still, still kind of on like relatively on fire. Like he leads the majors in RBIs, runs, hits, batting average, on base, and slugging, and by extension OPS. He's two home runs behind Christian Yelich, so Bellinger's at 14. it was interesting. Bellinger was 3 for 3 on Sunday. He entered the day, I think, 394. And that was weird because it was one of the rare times he had like fallen below 400 this year. But then he went 3 for 3, so he's back up to like 407 now. And look, it's May 12th or May 13th when we're recording this now. It's ridiculous to like talk about this now, but the fact that anyone's over 400 at any point, like after April, is always like a story to me. So it's very impressive. But also what's more impressive, so the Dodgers have played 43 games. At the end of those games, Cody Bellinger has been under 400. How many times would you guess out of the 43?
Two.
Oh, man, you undershot it. It's five.
A five?
Which is very impressive.
What a slacker.
Yeah, but so he was 333 after the second game of the season.
Okay. I thought it was only one of those, so.
No, but the other four came this week. So, like, he fell well behind. Like, his lowest was 394.
What a slacker.
Right. So, like, yeah, he just fell all the way to 394. So, good Lord, what a slumper. But, yeah, so then he's back. But what's funny, so his OPS after that second game, it was 1,067. And since then, he has not – his lowest is 1,234. So he's currently at 1,258. So he's already at, like, one of the lowest points of the season for him, and he has a 1,258 OPS. So this tells you what kind of a season he's had.
Mentioned earlier, the Dodgers went 5-2 this week, but it felt like a really, really good 5-2. And 5-2 is good to begin with.
Yeah. Well, and like if you look at it just without looking at the team's records who they played, like Braves and Nationals preseason sort of contenders in the NL East. So like they played the Braves in the playoffs last year. So 5-2 against that squad, pretty good. You look back a little bit and the Nationals have just been like completely slumping this year and terrible. Second straight year, basically after they fired Dusty Baker for, you know, dumb reasons. And so you're wondering what the hell is wrong with that organization, but they split with the Nationals after sweeping the Braves. It was kind of a weird week. Like, but at the end of it, like you look at the big picture, like 5-2 against those two teams, like you'll take that all the time. Like, and it's weird too because it could have been like even better, like just the way the week sort of played out. But
yeah, we have sort of you and I were talking before we recorded, sort of a kind of a weird grand slam on Saturday's game where it's like a fluky double play that wasn't, and then sort of some softer contact and sort of not horrible performances from Baez and Floro, just not clearly not their best.
Well, yeah, and so, yeah, Dylan Floro gave up a grand slam. He had the second time in about a week and a half where he came in with the bases loaded and gave up all the runs. And in a weird twist, like that inning, so the Dodgers were up 2-0 in the eighth, and the Nationals scored one, and then Gerardo Parra with two outs, he had a grand slam, and they won 5-2. Dylan Floro gave up the grand slam, but that was the only run he gave up. But because of the error, the run for the team was unearned. It because of a weird baseball rule, it should have been earned for Dylan Floro because a reliever doesn't get the benefit of like the doubt on an earlier play. Normally, with the way like scoring works, is if an error happens, you play the inning out as if an out happened or whatever was supposed to happen, and then you sort of play it accordingly. And so it was a weird thing. So Dylan Floro, he actually gave up 3 runs total on the season. They're all 3 are recently, but all 3 are unearned so far. The scorer screwed up on that. It should be earned for him, but unearned for the team. It's a very weird baseball quirk. It kind of screws up spreadsheets, I guess, in a way, because the totals don't add up. But for the moment, he still has a 0 ERA, which is funny. Last week for the Dodgers, the bullpen, they gave up 8 runs, but all of them were unearned. So the bullpen had a spotless 0 ERA for the week. It was very weird.
And in that Saturday game, there was a lot of good to talk about, specifically Walker Buehler.
Yeah, so both of his starts were really good. This last week, he pitched 7 innings twice, And on Saturday, he was scoreless, and he's like, he's been great. And like, Oral Hershiser on the broadcast was talking about this. He basically said, this is like the fully formed Walker Buehler we're seeing now. He's like, look, he had a one start in spring training. He started off slow. So like, that was basically his spring training. And then he saw him like sort of build it up a little bit and get better. And he did struggle early. And you were at one of the games. He actually hit a home run, but he did not pitch well. But so he's like basically where he's at. Had he had a full spring training, you know, or whatever, it seems like now. So he's looking very, very good, and sort of adding him to the, you know, the mix of the top of the rotation makes the Dodgers, I think, very formidable.
And yet he was the second best starting pitcher for the Dodgers this week.
Right. And wow,
not close.
So our good friend Gerardo Parra, who hit the Grand Slam Saturday in the eighth inning, came up in the eighth inning Sunday, and he singled, or was it a single or a double? I think it was a single.
It was a double, I think.
It was a double. That's right. It was over Jack Peterson's head, right? And but the significance of that was not that it helped the Nationals like take the lead or anything, but it was the first hit of the game against Hyunjin Ryu, who was dominant. Like, he had two starts this last week. He had a perfect game into the sixth on Monday. He settled for a four hit shutout. And then Sunday, he took a no-hitter into the eighth, ended up completing the eight innings, all scoreless. He did walk a batter Sunday, which was his first walk at home since, like, last August. He went, I think it was 66 and a third innings at home without a walk, including the playoffs, which is
ridiculous.
Dumb. Yeah, it's just, like, that doesn't happen. But so he, in many ways, Hyunjin Ryu failed this week because he did walk a batter, but... Yeah. But He worked his way around the walk and allowed zero runs over 17 innings. So he's at 173, I think. Yeah, once on the season, and he has a scoreless streak of 25 innings at the moment. So he has been like just ridiculous. Like, it's just crazy.
And I just want to quickly reiterate that the start against the Braves was not only a four hit shutout, it was a Maddux. Probably my favorite baseball.
Oh, right. Under 100 pitches, I think it was 93, something ridiculous. So, like, you know, when you're just completely in control and, like, you don't really give up anything and, like, it's almost like you're cruising, that's what Ryu was doing, and he's been doing it, like, all since the beginning of last season, really. His ERA since the start of 2018 during the regular season is 187, and that's the best in the majors. So good for him.
And I know there's a hitter you want to talk about, but just to stick to starting pitching just a little bit, what a sort of an about face from the first kind of few weeks where the rotation was a serious concern for the Dodgers. Granted, a lot of that was sort of built into the injuries that Kershaw and Hill had, but it looks like their biggest strength right now. Maybe their biggest strength that's not in
the
Cody
Bellinger. Definitely. Yeah, or yeah, and like you saw it, like the week, I think we can all clearly, we understand now, partially this is your fault for going into St. Louis.
I know, I'm sorry.
But no, so that week it was something like, I think for like six games, the Dodgers starters had like, it was something like as many runs as innings. It was like 26 runs in 26 innings or something dumb, where they were barely averaging like four innings. Part of that was Ryu got hurt in the second inning, one of the games, but like they were just terrible. And like pretty much they lost six games in a row. And then the Ross Stripling pitched like eight innings on a Sunday. And like since then, they've been like lights out as a staff, like for the most part. There's been a few hiccups, but just overall, they've been great. And part of that, you're right, getting Kershaw back, getting Hill back, although Hill has been like kind of hit or miss. And they moved him back. The Dodgers have a weird schedule in the next 2 weeks. They're off today. They're off Thursday this week, too. Next week, the same thing, two off days in a week. So four off days in a very short span, but they had also played more than anyone else in the first 7 weeks. So they maneuvered their rotational bits. They're moving Hill back, although it's just more, I don't know, but it doesn't matter. And also, I just wanted to clarify, I said 173 for Ryu. He's at 172, so I don't want to shortchange him.
There's a memo that the Dodgers hit a lot of home run and it got lost in the mail for Justin Turner, but boy, has he found it.
Man, so his, we've seen this, like, right, his MO has always been, like, part of it, he was hurt a couple Aprils, so, like, that played into it, but he still only has, like, he has 3 April home runs in his career, and, like, he has 99 home runs, and not, you know, including his time away from the Dodgers, but just to only have 3 in April is kind of bizarre, and, like, he has 3 in 480 career plate appearances, so it's not like it's a huge thing. But as we've seen, like, as the sort of summer months heat up, he's either healthier or it just starts to heat up as well. And that was the case this last week. So he had, like I said, 1 home run in April, and end of last Sunday, Turner was at a 707 OPS. So at the end of the week, and of course, like during a live podcast recording, like that's like the best time for pages not to load. But oh no, so he was at 707 OPS, and now he's already back in 1 week. He's up to 845. So we mentioned, like, you know, while he was slumping a little bit, his batted ball numbers did show he was hitting the ball harder, and he should have been getting the better results. And boy, did he get them this week! So he had 5 home runs during the week, giving him 6 on the year. 3 of those came Tuesday. So the Dodgers have had at least one player hit 3 home runs for 5 straight years. They've never done that before. But yeah, he's sort of rounding into form. And like I said, anytime you have, I mean, he's the driver of their offense. I know Cody Bellinger has been great, but like Turner's been like that consistent guy in the 3 or the 4 or the 2 or whatever spot, somewhere in the heart of the order. He's been that consistent guy for like 3-4 years. So to have him getting back to where he normally is always a good thing.
Now, we have some questions from Craig, but real quick, we normally, or maybe not normally, but frequently would have questions from Twitter here, or you would have another note you wanted to pass along kind of just as a side note. And we got nothing. And I blame this team being just a little bit too good.
Yeah, covering the team for like a decade, basically, I thought the worst it was going to be was 2009. Like the Dodgers were a 95 win team. They had the best record in the National League. And that season was hellish in the comment section of Truebill. I just remember it was terrible. You would think this team was like so bad. And even though the team was winning, the comments were, it was awful. And, you know, they've improved a little bit over the years. You know, we've fostered the community a little bit. But just generally comments, I don't want to generalize, but they're often terrible and mean-spirited and bad. And the worse the team is, you would think the worse the comments are. But sometimes it doesn't always adhere to that. But, yeah, like, they're just – there's not a lot to complain about, I guess the bullpen's always, even though when the bullpen's good, though, people complain about it. Or like when the Dodgers are still scoring, they're like, well, they can't hit with runners in scoring position, even when they are. Like, so like none of it's rational, but like there are actually reasons to gripe. Like the bullpen's been pretty bad, like just generally, like, you know, very few reliable.
Yeah, but I think this week the starters have been so good, they haven't had a lot of time to show that off.
Right. Like, for instance, so like Sunday, right? We mentioned the Ryu shutout, and then he pitched 8. Kenley Jansen pitched Sunday for the first time in a week. Ross Stripling didn't even get into a game last week. Like, Julio Urias had the Dodgers 2 saves. Monday was one of them because Kenley had pitched like 3 days in a row, so he was off. And then he had a 3-inning save, which, you know, happens like in a blowout usually. So, but actually, he actually came in with only a 3-run lead, but he ended up doing a 3-inning save. So, and you know how much I love 3-inning saves.
I do.
Like, so, yeah, like, you'd be amazed. Like, great starters tend to make bullpens greater because, A, they're not taxing them, and then so the bullpen gets better rested, and then it's like this weird domino effect that happens, and everyone sort of gets better. It's a multiplier. So that's what we've seen happen, I think. So there's, like I said, not much to sort of complain about. And then, like I said, sort of picking nits here, but they do have Rocky Gale on the active roster now, so all due respect to Rocky Gale. So there's plenty of room to like still like get better.
But I imagine as they keep doing a good job hiding Joe Kelly will still have less questions. As soon as he pitches three times, four times in a week, we're going to have 10 copies of the same question, I'm sure.
Yeah. And, well, like we were talking about this before, like, usually it's something along the lines of, should they catapult Joe Kelly into the sun? Like, should they feed him to a pack of wild hyenas? You know, that kind of, it's usually stuff like that. So looking forward to more of those later in the year.
All right, here we go. Questions from Craig. Are you ready?
Yay.
Yay. Yeah. Per Baseball Reference, Cody Bellinger has a 4.4 WAR this season. The LA franchise record is Adrian Beltre's 9.6 WAR 2004 season. Can Bellinger break that record?
I mean, he could. But, like, man, it's really hard to have a 10 WAR year.
That was such a good season.
Yeah, like, and what's funny, like, so I saw, I for the most part, I try not to look at the questions from Craig ahead of time. I like being surprised, but he sent me, there's a question that you're going to answer, and he sent me a text with the answer to it, so I was compelled, and I looked at this, and I saw it, and my first thought was, wait a minute, what about Matt Kemp's 2011? Because there were times where I think he was up near 10 WAR a little bit, and I think, I can't remember when, but there was some adjustment to, like, maybe it was defensive numbers or replacement level or something, but, like, I just looked, his 2011, where he nearly went 40-40 and almost won the Triple Crown, he had an 8 WAR year, so, but this goes to show you how good Beltre's 9.6 was, but, yeah, I mean, look, 9.6, I'm not gonna, like, if you told me Cody Bellinger, right, would have a 5.2 win season, I would take that any day of the week. So to say, like, yes, he's going to have that in, like, less than 5 months, I can't commit to that. So I'm going to say he will not surpass Adrian Beltre this year.
All right. Second question is for me. Mm-hmm. Do you have it up, or do I have to read my own trivia question?
No, I will read it. Yeah. So, okay. So as we know, NBA playoffs are going. Craig said with the NBA season, I think he meant the entire season, including the playoffs, but we just started. The second round is over. Conference finals are set. It was actually a very exciting second round. But Jacob, as we know, you're an Indianapolis Pacers fan. So Craig's question to you, 3 Pacers have been selected to play 4 or more All-Star games since the 89-90 season. Can you name them? I'll get to the second one after.
Real quick, it's the Indiana Pacers. I want to make sure that's clear.
Oh wow, yeah. I was reading it for a minute. You're right. Yeah.
It's a thing. Pacer fans get prickly about. I screw it up about half the time because it is the Indianapolis Colts, but the Indiana Pacers. So
Craig writes the minor league reports a lot, and so. I would just give him the benefit of the doubt and say he was thinking of Triple-A Indianapolis on his mind.
So anyways, so I looked at this question, but I did no research ahead of time. So I have my 4 best guesses, and I've got some backups. So the obvious one's Reggie Miller.
That is correct. He is one of them. He was an All-Star 5 times during that time period.
Only 5. Oh my gosh.
I know. I would have thought like 10 or something like that. Like he was annually like at the, if he, even if he wasn't like, he was like popular to the point where people thought he was like greater than he was. Not to say he wasn't great, but like almost like a Derek Jeter or something where he was elevated to some other plane.
His importance to the franchise sort of.
Oh, no question.
That, so.
And I don't even put it against him that he went to UCLA.
Okay. Paul George?
That is also correct. He was a 4-time All-Star.
Rick Smits?
No. There's only one more here. I don't have his up, but I'm gonna pull it up as we're going.
Oh,
here.
It's only 3. I thought it was 4. So
no, it's 4 time All-Star, but there's only 3 of them.
Okay. Jermaine O'Neal.
That is correct. So okay. I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt.
No, assume. I would have not. I would have guessed Jermaine before Rick Smits. I thought I was going for 4.
Just looking it up. Actually, wow, Smits was only an All-Star once. How is that possible?
He was
the Dutch boy in the paint.
It was a really good era for centers. Like that didn't shock me that he wasn't there.
I mean, look, he was in the East, right? And it basically was Shaq his entire career. Although not his entire career, but like the first half. So, like, I get it. Like, right? He was, and then, like, Alonzo Mourning and stuff. So, it makes sense. But, yeah. So, oh, yeah. So, Jermaine O'Neal had the most. He had six.
Where did...
I would not have guessed.
No, Jermaine was really, really good for a really long time. Did Patrick Ewing go to the All-Star game as a power forward or center? Do you know?
Oh, well...
Because that's who I was figuring was...
He was always a center.
Okay. Yeah. It's one of those things where now and then they randomly will, like, hoist them in a different spot. And looking,
the way they do it now is, like, front court, back court. But, like, yeah, it used to be pretty set positions.
So,
or guard forward center, at least.
So, yeah. So there you go. Hey, I did okay.
So, yeah, you were. I consider you 3 for 3. And I will even... The fact that you brought up Rick Smith warms my heart. Because he had... Dutch Boy in the Paint is one of the great nicknames of all time. So...
You have another question, I think, and it's a really obvious answer.
Oh yeah. So the follow-up from Greg, who is your favorite Pacer and why?
So I'm especially attuned to be a Reggie Miller fan, being a UCLA graduate Pacer fan, on top of the fact of how, by and large, he's the best, certainly NBA, and you should probably argue, greatest Pacer ever. So... And in the era that my sports love and was really formative, thinking back of that 2000 finals appearance, really probably the first sports series I really, really followed deeply and was made fun of by all my Laker friends, all of that. So it really entrenched this identity I had as the Indiana fan in a Laker town. So
I also enjoyed the 2000.
Rick Smits is kind of high up there.
It was
Ron Artest for a while, and then he threw away the Pacers' best chance at a championship almost single-handedly. I have a bunch of other weird former Pacers. Jeff Foster, Austin Crozier.
Oh my god, that's classic. Okay, this is great. So I'm not going to rub this in. I will just say that this is going to sound like an asshole. I'll just give you where my mindset is at because I don't feel this way anymore. Mm-hmm. So I grew up at the tail end of Showtime with the Lakers. Mm-hmm. And so my first like full year of watching basketball was 86-87 when the Lakers won the first of two back-to-back championships. And Magic Johnson won MVP the first of those years. And he ended up winning like 3 MVPs in 4 years. And I was hooked, right? Like the Lakers were my everything. Watch them like religiously. Obviously I was a bigger baseball fan, but there was like literally one year where like, look, I didn't have a car, yet. I forgot what year it was. I think it was like 91, 92, or maybe it's probably that year where I literally watched every single game on TV, like all 82 games and every playoff game. Like, like if you think about it, that's a big time commitment. But when you're like a kid and you don't have much to do, like, it's not that impressive, but I always thought it was like an accomplishment when it's really not. It's just me watching on TV. It's kind of dumb, but like I was super into it. I never thought I was like used to the championships, but it was like I find myself like missing that. And then I look back and it seems ridiculous now, but I just remember when the Lakers got Kobe and Shaq in '96. So like they had 3 years of them like sort of gelling together, and they didn't put it all together. And then 2000 was the year they finally won it. But that was tough because they almost blew a 3-1 lead to the Blazers in the Western Conference Finals. And then in my mind, I was thinking, man, it's been 12 years since the Lakers won a championship. And, like, this is so long. And then, and I'm just telling you my honest opinion. And then, I was so happy with that championship. It was great. Like, that was... that was so great. But then I flash forward to like in 2009, this was post Shaq when Kobe and Powell, they beat the Magic. And I remember when they won, and this is going to sound like an asshole again, I felt like nothing. I was like, I don't get the same like joy from it anymore. I did get it the next year when they beat the Celtics, which was weird because the whole rivalry, like, you know, kind of, you know, sort of stoked those fires, I guess. And I literally, I forgot at some point they threw the ball down the end of the court till I almost ran the timeout. And I literally jumped like the Toyota commercial, like in the air, like jumped for joy. But yeah, I've never felt that way with a championship. Like it just doesn't do anything for me. like it did, but like that 2000 team, it did for me. And like, so that's why, it was very cool.
Do you know, so I'm not sure how much you follow sort of non-Laker NBA, but the Pacers have been the historically pretty good franchise for my entire life. Do you know the last time the Pacers had a single-digit draft pick?
Oh, wow. So, yeah, because they've always, like, even in their sort of quote-unquote bad years, they've been, like, mid-40s wins, right, for a long time.
So they had they've had a top 10 pick in 2010, which was Paul George. And prior to that, their next top 10 pick was in 96. And their last single, their own, they traded for the pick that became Jonathan Bender. But their last own single-digit draft pick was 1989, where it was George McLeod. And the last the top three pick was Rick Smits in 88.
Amazing. That's pretty good.
Yeah, it's a good recipe for being what they are, but they're going to have to get really fortunate to kind of really push over the edge, which I hope they do. I am a fairly big Pacers fan, obviously, but my brother is take all my love and triple it. So for his sake, I really, really hope the Pacers can pull just one. We're not greedy. Just pull one off. Go ahead.
I would think like if Oladipo is healthy, like
at least, you know,
like, yeah,
they're getting to the Eastern Conference Finals, maybe, as a sort of
season. Because when they traded Paul George, right, it was like, well, there's the beginning. Like, they're going to start to tear it down, and then they're like, still good and, like, sort of better.
Yeah, take LeBron to seven games. This is great. Let's do an NBA podcast.
But then, like, this year, like, they had the same similar thing where they were like, okay, they didn't make the jump that they thought they would. But then, like, when Oladipo got hurt, they were better still. I was like, what?
So they were the three seed in the East for a really long time,
right?
And they held on to it for a while. So
maybe they're Wolverine. Like, maybe they like, no matter what you do to them, they're at this base level of competence where no matter how, like, what you do, they're gonna still, like, win 45 games, like, no matter what. So that's funny.
Well, I have a question for you real quick before I do. Shout out to current favorite Pacer Miles Turner.
Okay.
And before him, Roy Hibbert, love me, who, you know, sort of soured in Pacers fans' mind, but he's kind of come back.
Laker legend, Roy Hibbert.
You're right. Give me a defensive-oriented big man. I'm excited. All right, ready for your trivia question?
Yes.
Joe Kelly, hey, he found his way here, has an 8.80 ERA in 15 games played. Four other LA Dodgers have had a season of an 8 ERA or higher, with 15 or more games pitched. Can you name them?
Okay, so
for our listeners, he has a note that the first one was in 2001 and the last one was 2015. And one more hit. I don't think you need this, Eric. But for our listeners, three of them were as relievers and one did it as a starter.
Okay, so when I saw the note about 2001, well, one of the first names that came to mind, but I don't know if he pitched 15 games, which is the weird thing for me, but I'm just going to say Oral Hershiser. But actually, now that I think about it, his last year was 2000 and not 2001. So maybe it's not him.
It's not Oral.
Okay. So now this is going to be worse than I thought then. one for sure is Hideo Nomo.
Correct. 18 games started in 2004.
He just like completely fell off the face of the earth.
My favorite Dodger, by the way.
He was so good.
Not that year.
Right. But he was very good in 2003, and then to do that, like, it was weird. Okay, so I knew Nomo. I thought Oral. So in my head, I'm like, I'm at least getting two. But then the third one I was thinking of, is it Kevin Correa?
No. Nope.
I don't think he pitched 15 games either.
Yeah.
Damn, this is, like, tougher than I thought.
So one of these names I thought you would get, and I think you're going to kick yourself when you hear it.
There's no question I'm going to kick, especially 2015. I should be able to get, but for the life of me, like,
it is a reliever the Dodgers made a trade for.
Right.
To you.
Yeah. I don't think. Roberto Hernandez was not there, so I don't know.
Jim Johnson.
Oh, man, Jim Johnson. He is so bad.
That's a, I would have gotten none of these names because I think I blacked out the 2004 year for Nomo. Soon as I saw Jim Johnson's name, I was like, oh yeah, that was bad.
Jim Johnson, man. That I mean,
what a weird weird season.
He was like, he was like good everywhere but the Dodgers. Like he was like good before they got him, and then good after they got him, but not good with the Dodgers. Like, so, God, that was so bad. Oh, yeah, that was
his,
really bad.
So that season, his ERA plus with the Dodgers was 37, and with the Braves was 172. What a weird, weird thing.
And to put that just in like actual like run terms, so he pitched 48 innings for the Braves and gave up 14 runs, 12 earned runs, but 14 runs, 48 innings. For the Dodgers, he pitched 18 and two-thirds innings and gave up 22 runs. So amazing. What an amazing, wow, that's incredible.
So you have two more. I'll just get, you want to take another stab?
You
want
me to give me, can you give me the years?
2001 and 2011.
Oh, yeah. 2011.
The 2001 was in 28 games. 2011 was in 40 games.
28 games. I wish, I'm just blanking. I don't know.
2001 was Greg Olson.
Cool. Okay, nice.
And then 2011 was Hunchi Kuo.
Oh, okay. Yeah, he had the unfortunate, like, I'm too hurt to do stuff.
Yeah.
And then, like, yeah. Oh, well.
Next up, sorry,
I lost my
notepad. Here we are. Would you basically plan to use Urias for two or more innings in every Maeda start right now? If not, how would you two use him until he starts games again?
I mean, so much of this to me
depends on kind of what the medical staff says, as opposed, like, it, because I imagine it's possibly more than just a simple, over the course of the year, keep his innings to X. I bet it's like how you actually use him may depend. And if that's the situation where you're going to use him less frequently, but in a longer stint to try and keep the arm, you know, a little bit lengthened, then that's different than if he just becomes this guy you can bring in all the time in key high leverage situations.
Yeah, and like, as much as you want to plan for it, you can never really plan for that. Like, oh, today we're going to pitch Maeda and Urias. You know, like, it just never works out that way. Like, so, like the day before, like, Rich Hill might go like four and you need a long guy or something. So, like, you just have him at the ready. Yeah, I think he's going to be like basically a two inning reliever. But at times, like, we saw this, like, he was rested and Kenley was pitched for three straight games. So they went to Urias to close the game out and he was fine. So, I think it's going to be mix and match. It's just like, I don't think there's a set way to sort of do it, but they're just going to sort of use them as needed.
Last question. And we haven't had a food question yet, so you knew it was coming. In a perfect world, does every hamburger come with a toasted bun?
I mean, knee jerk, no way. Like, I don't mind a toasted bun, but I don't go out of my way to get one. And sometimes I like
buns, but there's especially sliders. There's some sliders where I just want that sort of
soft,
mushy bread to soap up all the mustard and stuff.
Yeah, and like sometimes you just want the softness of the bread, like, and sometimes the crispiness or the toastiness works like to a great deal. But man, sometimes like that softness, like for some reason, like In-N-Out, I know they lightly toast them. But their bread is still very spongy and soft. And so I kind of like that. It's probably a mix of both, actually, come to think of it. But I think the softer the better for me. As long as it's like structurally, you know, it doesn't like fall apart. But I don't really toast mine. I don't go out of my way to toast them.
That's the episode, Eric.
Yeah,
that's the last question. But you have a Dodgers rewind for us, and one I'm really excited about too.
Right. So the this is a little bit of a weird one, only because I mean, like, I've just thrown these together a little bit in recent weeks. I haven't had a lot of preparation on some of these, but I think part of that is like I try to make them relevant to what's going on, and so I wait to see what's happening, and like sometimes I'll like just randomly look at old baseball cards and be like, oh, that guy's interesting. But so yesterday Ryu, he's had three straight starts of eight innings. He allowed one run in the first of those and none in the last two. But so Kazuto Yamazaki yesterday tweeted, Ryu is the first non-Kershaw Dodgers lefty to throw back-to-back shutout starts of eight innings or more. And this is one of those classic, like, so many, like, qualifiers, but it's great. The first one to do that since Rick Honeycutt, his current pitching coach, June 5th to the 10th, 1986. And this is not – I mean, look, I just wanted to point out Rick Honeycutt for the most part, like, for one thing, like he's been a very, very good pitching coach. Like mm-hmm. I think a lot of people rave about him in baseball. He's very good at working with pitchers. He sort of has individual plans for each pitcher. He's not rigid. He doesn't, you know, you have to do this. Like you don't hear a lot of times, I think, about players leaving the Dodgers going, they didn't want me to do this. They didn't want me to throw my slider. They wanted me to only do that. You know, they offer suggestions. They use a lot of data. And Honeycutt's like, worked with multiple front offices, and he's been like made the transitions like seamless. But this is his 14th year as pitching coach, and you look back through Dodgers history, he's the longest tenured pitching coach in Dodgers history. Like they didn't have pitching coaches like in the 40s, like it was like informal, you know. But like so, Ron Paranofsky actually also did 14 years. He was 81 to 94. Red Adams was before him, 69 to 80. So he did 12. So they had like, and Joe Becker from 55 to 65. Joe Becker was their first official pitching coach. So those guys are the ones who lasted like a decade or more. But like Honeycutt's right there with Paranofsky and is like, you know, the longest tenured in Dodger history. So it's amazing. But he also pitched for 21 years in the majors. Like he ended his career like in, not ended it, but he sort of rejuvenated it in his mid 30s. With those like Tony La Russa bullpens with the A's after the Dodgers actually traded him to Oakland. But like, and he started a lot. He won the ERA title in the American League in 83. And actually that year, that was a year he was actually traded to the Dodgers like in August or maybe, yeah. And so it was a weird year, weird way. Like, so the Dodgers in the winter meetings in 1982, they were hell-bent on getting a catcher, right? They were unsure of Mike Socha. They wanted an upgrade. Jim Sundberg was an all-star with the Rangers, veteran guy. They had this huge deal worked out with the Rangers where if you look back, you're like, what's one of those, like, thank God they didn't do this deal. But so here's the deal. The Dodgers had a deal in place at the winter meetings. They were going to send Bert Hooten, pitcher, a minor league outfield named Mark Bradley, and then pitchers Dave Stewart, who was a minor leaguer, or he pitched briefly in the majors, and a minor league pitcher named Oral Hershiser. Sundberg had, like, I think it was 8 years left on his contract at the time. They had these weird – this was, like, the infancy of free agencies, so the players had weird deals. Baseball had weird rules at the time, so he had a right to, like, renegotiate his deal to approve it. So to approve the trade, Sundberg wanted them to, like it was something like he wanted to like reduce it to like 4 years or something. He wanted more flexibility, and the Dodgers were like, no, we want your contract as it is. So the deal fell through and they didn't do it. But like later in 83, they still made a trade with the Rangers and did send Dave Stewart along the way. But that was in the deal that got them Rick Honeycutt. And Rick Honeycutt, for the most part, was a starter with the Dodgers. He relieved a little bit, but he was with them from 83 to 87. He was traded midway in 87 to the A's. Dodgers and A's made a lot of trades, like a lot of deals together in a 12-month period, and they ended up meeting in the World Series. It was very weird. But Honeycutt, in his Dodger career, he started 108 games. There's only been 66 Dodgers who started 100 games with the franchise, and he's one of them. And it's funny, so Ryu, he started 104 games, so Honeycutt's 61st in franchise history and starts, and Ryu 62nd. So they're kind of linked in that way. But that's kind of it. Like he pitched, like I said, 21 years. That's amazing. But he's been Dodgers pitching coach for longer than anybody. So
yeah,
good for him.
I wouldn't. If you had asked me how long has Cunningcutt been the pitching coach, like it both feels like, does not feel like 14 years. Does not feel that long because it feels like that first few seasons was yesterday. But also feels ever present. It's kind of weird right. That it's that similar at the same time.
Yeah, his first year was 06, and they drafted Kershaw that year. So gives you and then you think about it, man, Kershaw's been here that long. Like, all right. So that's weird. But yeah, so that's our podcast this week, everybody. Thanks for listening. And we won't have as many games to talk about next week because they have a weird schedule, but I'm sure we'll have a lot to talk about and probably more Joe Kelly. So thanks for listening and see you next week.